KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
We had about 5 cameras destroyed and footage taken. And it's always the footage that gets taken that you're like, you sort of romanticize it, that this was everything that you ever wanted to capture and it's gone.
Jahan Nujaim is the filmmaker behind the new documentary, The Square. She shot the revolution in the streets of Egypt, where the police and military were not her friends. We also talk with one of the individuals she follows in the film, Khaled Abdullah, an actor and activist who joined the fight for change. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, Netflix gets into the superhero business with Marvel. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, CBS announced some very strong, in line with expectation, but strong earnings this week and showing a lesser dependence on advertising for its revenue, which is important in this era where there's a lot of options and ways to get your programming. But one point that Les Moonves, the chairman of the company, made strongly is that by next spring, when the upfronts roll around and the advertisers are being asked to buy time in programming, CBS expects to get credit and paid for not only when you watch a show as it's being broadcast live, but live plus 7, meaning if you watch it within 7 days. Now, they fought and won the broadcast networks, to get paid for viewing, for ratings, based on live viewing plus 3 days. And they are saying that so many people are recording these things at this point that it only makes sense for them to get paid for a full week's worth of playback on shows such as Hostages, which has been a series that's struggled a little bit but does better when you factor all that stuff in. So that is what they want, and that is what they intend to get.
Well, and the statistics are very much in their favor. The statistics show that those 4 to 7 days, meaning day 4, 5, 6, and 7, viewership for a lot of shows is up almost 20% in that period. And a lot of shows get 1 million extra viewers in that 4 to 7 day period. So that's one important factor. And the other important factor, which to me defies logic, is that even if people wait as much as 7 days to watch a show, as many as half of them do not skip through the commercials. If I delay watching TV by 5 minutes, I skipped through all the commercials. So it defies logic, but Nielsen, which tracks these things, claim that advertisers still get their commercial scenes a week later. And for the networks, it's a huge difference because the more viewers, the higher ad rates they can charge.
Yes, so they're assuming that we're all sitting there watching those commercials instead of running to the bathroom or making a sandwich. Meanwhile, in the streaming programming world, Netflix, which we've talked about many, many times as it's built itself up into this force, is striking out some new initiatives. Ted Sarandos, the chief content officer, kind of threw a bomb in a speech he gave a couple of weeks ago talking about how he really doesn't like the delay between the time when movies are released in theaters and when they're available to stream. Really rattled the theater owners and had to kind of walk back a little bit from those remarks. But Netflix is showing that it is absolutely very, very serious about kind of conquering all in terms of television and movies.
Yeah, and specifically in nonfiction movies, with this recent announcement that they're going to become a bigger player with documentaries. Now, Netflix is already a home to tons of documentaries. They've been a huge force for nonfiction filmmakers. And the move now is to get into picking up new films, meaning they're not going to wait months or years until these films have played out at every film festival and theatrically. They're going to bring them directly to Netflix subscribers. And the documentary filmmakers that my colleagues and I have spoken to think it's a very good thing, even though the details about the deal itself are a little bit murky. And I think one thing that bears consideration is Netflix has been very famous for binge viewing. And documentaries, unlike narrative features, don't necessarily fit into a 2-hour package. And we talked to Andrew Jarecki, who did Capturing the Freedmans, He said there's probably a five-hour movie that he could have made. A decade ago, there's a great six-hour documentary called The Staircase. So maybe there's a binge-viewing analogy that would work for longer documentaries in Netflix. I think for the filmmakers, it's going to really bring a lot more moviegoers to their stories. Unclear what the economics are going to be.
But the first one that Netflix has picked up in this respect is The Square. We're talking with the filmmaker behind that film today. This is about the revolution in Egypt and a very gritty, on-the-ground documentary. And this could give Netflix an entree into Oscar because that film is considered a promising potential nominee. And Netflix already elbowed its way into the Emmys with House of Cards. And I think the Hollywood establishment that's been a little bit rattled by Netflix with its model of throwing everything up online at once and letting you binge if you want to, a whole season of House of Cards, whatever, they might find it a little daunting that Netflix could elbow its way into the best documentary race just with this one stroke.
Yeah, but at least from theater owners' perspective, it's not as if a lot of people show up for documentaries anyway. So there's not a lot of competition at the movie theaters for these kinds of films.
On the other hand, Netflix has just made a deal with Disney's Marvel, the home of Thor and Iron Man and the Avengers and all of these properties, to do four series, 13 episodes apiece, that you will be able to watch on demand. It's not clear if they're throwing them all up at the same time for binging, but I'm going to guess that probably is part of the equation. And it's really kind of a striking deal since Disney also owns its own networks. It owns ABC. It owns ABC Family. It has other properties where it could put these Marvel characters, and yet they have elected to put these four on Netflix.
Yeah, it raises the question whether or not ABC passed on these four series, which are Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and Luke Cage. And Marvel properties, as you said, are huge right now. I think there's the risk there's going to be too much Marvel. It reminds me a little bit of ABC not that long ago with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire when they threw it on every night and they killed the franchise within a matter of months.
ABC does already have Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is doing well, but there is a question of what the saturation point is. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can stay in touch with us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up, Shooting a Revolution in Progress. As we discussed in the banter, Netflix may have found its way into the Oscar race by acquiring The Square, a street-level documentary about political turmoil in Egypt. Our guests today are The Square filmmaker, Jahan Nujaim, and Egyptian actor and activist Khaled Abdullah. Nujaim is an American-born filmmaker who spent much of her childhood in Cairo. She shot the well-regarded 2004 documentary Control Room about the news channel Al Jazeera and its coverage of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. She also shot a documentary called Egypt, We're Watching You, which follows a group of women seeking to monitor parliamentary elections in that country. As an actor, Abdullah appeared in the films The Kite Runner and United 93. He was raised in London by a family of Egyptian activists. So when Egypt was on the brink of revolution in 2011, he took to the heart of the protests in Tahrir Square and became one of the individuals Nujaim follows in her film.
I'm just waiting for the speech. You don't normally get so much time to try and work out where you're going to be standing when something historic happens and the bastard is making his wait.
The revolution in Egypt brought about the fall of Hosni Mubarak after 30 years of dictatorship. That led to the election of Mohamed Morsi, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, to the presidency. The version of The Square that Nujaim took to Sundance earlier this year ended there, and that film won an audience award. But Nujaim knew that the turmoil in Egypt wasn't nearly over. She returned to Tahrir Square to cover the mass uprising against Morsi that led to his overthrow this summer, and she recut the film to include those events. That's the version that is now playing in theaters in New York and Los Angeles, and that will be released on Netflix in January. Throughout, Nujaim and her crew were filming in often chaotic and dangerous conditions on the street as protesters clashed with the military, the police, and sometimes each other. Nujaim was detained a couple of times, the first upon her arrival in Cairo after the protests in Tahrir Square began in January 2011.
I talked to friends of mine on the street who had been, you know, marching on January 25th, 26th, they said, bring a Canon camera because it's small and it won't get confiscated. So I did that and got back into Cairo after the military had actually taken to the streets already. So there were checkpoints all over the place. I landed, got stopped at one of the checkpoints. They found all of these DVDs of my previous film called Egypt, We're Watching You. Not the best title to find as the country is exploding by military intelligence. So they took me in, questioned me for about 6 hours. And at a certain point, I tried to get rid of the DVDs by shoving them down a drain and breaking them up. And somebody went back into the interrogation room. Somebody found them. The guy cleaning the bathrooms held up this shard of glass as evidence. And of course, I obviously had no choice but to tell the truth because I had been lying for about 8 hours that I had never made any kind of political film. Because I didn't know who I was talking to, so, and I'd never been in that situation before, so I didn't know what to expect. And I think at that moment of just coming clean and telling the truth, regardless of the consequences, there was something inside me. I felt this kind of freedom. Things changed inside of me. It's a bit of a, it's a revolution on the outside, but it's also a revolution on the inside. And I think what I was feeling at that moment when I became truthful about what I was doing was a tiny, tiny little piece of maybe what people were feeling when they went down to the streets, what many people felt.
So despite the fact that you told the truth, they didn't detain you further?
They questioned me for about another hour and then they let me go. So, you know, maybe I should have told the truth from the beginning, but there were people that were being led into rooms blindfolded. I didn't know who was interrogating me. So it was a nerve-wracking situation. And there's also self-censorship that goes on. I grew up, you know, since 1980 in Egypt, where family members say, you know, there's secret police and you don't know where. I mean, it's a, we're living under emergency law, living under that kind of environment, it's not conducive to saying exactly what you think about the political situation.
I wonder, like, when you are setting out to make this film, let me just start with the business basic. How is it financed? Who's backing it? It's such a charged topic.
Nobody. I mean, if we had gone to a television station to back it, two things. I think that there would have been a lot of pressure to end the film where a lot of films ended, which was the step down of Mubarak after
right.
18 days.
The sort of so-called happy ending.
The happy ending. Mm-hmm. Why are you continuing to film? What really is the storyline?
And when you say a TV station, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you mean an Egyptian TV station?
No, any TV station. Any Western or, you know, any television station
right.
that would put some initial financing into a film like this.
Right.
Then secondly, to be represented, it was very important as filmmakers that we were only representing ourselves as independent filmmakers, curious about where this was going and documenting.
Right, because if it's any kind of company from anywhere, that would be freighted with meaning.
That's exactly right. It couldn't be a Western production. It couldn't be Al Jazeera. It couldn't be a Qatari production. You know, it had to be Egyptian individuals that were trying to tell this story.
So what do you do for money? I mean, I'm sorry, it's a personal question
no,
in a way.
It's a very good question. You have a team of filmmakers that are operating on fumes and believe in telling this story and are figuring out other ways to survive and not getting paid. I borrowed money from friends and family to make it. You know, we've been operating on fumes for almost 3 years.
You're listening to The Business from KCRW, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Jahan Nujaim, whose new movie, The Square, documents 2 years of revolution in Egypt. Joining her is one of the activists she follows in the film, Khaled Abdullah. He's an actor who appeared in three Hollywood movies that he's jokingly referred to as his War on Terror trilogy, United 93, The Kite Runner, and The Green Zone. How did you come to be part of this film?
Jahan found me. She did an interview with me. Had I known that at that point that would mean that I would end up in the film and my life filmed in quite the way that it was, I don't know what I would have done. You know, I've discovered that it is much harder to be yourself in a documentary film than it is to play a character in a fiction film.
That's interesting, because you're self-conscious about everything you do in a way that you don't have to be with a line written by somebody
it's
else.
It's not so much this, you know, it's more actually that, you know, there are moments at which in a documentary film being made, it can feel like a camera is intervening in life. And being an actor, you're very sensitive to when it feels false. And I would always run away whenever it felt like the camera was coming at me to try and ask me to do something that I wasn't already doing.
So were you busy acting when you, this Arab Spring, as it's called, were you busy and then saying, I need to go to Egypt?
I had just finished a film called In the Last Days of the City, which it was called before the revolution started. I'd been filming for 2 years. It's a film focused on Cairo, but also shot in Beirut and Baghdad, about a documentary filmmaker who's making a film about his city and the sense that things can't keep going on like this.
It's getting very meta right now.
I know. And then I end up in a documentary film afterwards filming. It's odd because I was the only person in that film who was actually playing a fictional character. And then it turns out that I was playing a version of myself only just before it turned into me.
It's very confusing. Okay, so you, and one of the striking things to me in watching the film is everyone is filming. I mean, you have several moments of really, oftentimes it's when a very frightening confrontation is on the brink of happening. You see the army or police are lined up, see the demonstrators. And as soon as the encounter happens, everyone in the crowd lifts up their phone and starts shooting. Is that, Khaled, is that a thing that people are told to do or an instinct that people have now in today's world?
I mean, it's a mix of things. I mean, it's definitely instinctive. I mean, you are immensely aware, and people were right from the beginning, of the disconnect between the story that is being told about what's happened and what actually happened when you experience it. And everyone, or not everyone, but a lot of people have a weapon in their pocket which has a camera on it in which they can film to be able to prove what actually happened. And
you mean like a gun with a camera on it? Or are you
no,
saying
no,
literally
I mean, no,
a weapon?
No, I mean a weapon as in a phone with a camera.
Right, gotcha. Okay, just want to be clear.
No. And, you know, one of the lines that's in the film, but the battle is also in the images and it's in the stories.
Did you use that kind of footage at all within your film?
The kind of footage, you mean cell phone footage?
Yeah.
And in the film, there's the images that you see when Khaled shows Cinema Tahrir, where he shows on, you know, in the square, he projects to people what has been happening in the square. There's another moment where tanks are running over people. That was filmed with cameras on the phone and handy cams. And most of it, I mean, we were five cameras off and on in the square for 3 years. So we basically filmed, you know, most of the film ourselves.
Yeah, one of the things I wondered, you know, you're very much down in the, on the ground, running through crowds, you know, the cameras running and sliding all over the place as sometimes you're stopped or your camera people were stopped. And there are a couple of places at least where somebody, army or police, someone like that, mm-hmm. you know, literally knocks the camera to the ground and it goes black. And
we had about five cameras destroyed and footage taken. And it's always Khaled and I were talking about this the other day. It's always the footage that gets taken that you're like, you sort of romanticize it. And you
it was so good.
You remember that this was everything that you ever wanted to capture and it's gone.
But it does seem that in those cases, when there's somebody literally saying, stop it, bam, and it goes dark, you have that footage. And I wondered how you get it back.
The particular time that you're talking about in the film was somebody who was shooting on the film named Khaled Negi, who I think he did a very quick, tricky, amazing maneuver where he managed to get the card out of the camera and stick it in his pocket. There's also cameras which, you know, I think people got away with this for a while until the army and police figured it out. And it depended on who was catching you, whether they had good knowledge of the cameras or not. There are some cameras that actually have two slots. So if you stick a card in one of the slots and you just open that slot and give them an empty card.
You're letting away all the secrets now.
Yeah. No.
Coming up after a short break, having won an audience award at Sundance, the filmmakers behind The Square return to Cairo to shoot more political turmoil in Egypt. You can make a comment about today's show at kcrw.com/thebusiness.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The title of the documentary, The Square, refers to Tahrir Square, the heart of the Egyptian Revolution. The film was shot on the streets of Cairo starting in January 2011. 2 years later, filmmaker Jahan Najim and her associates brought the square to the Sundance Film Festival, where it won an audience award. But that's not the version of the movie being released now. Even as Najim and Khaled Abdullah, an activist who appears in the square, were arriving in Park City for the Sundance Film Festival, there were tens of thousands of protesters back in Tahrir Square. This time, they were calling for the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. The revolution was not nearly over.
A few weeks before we went to Sundance, Morsi was starting to use the tools of democracy to create another dictatorship. And a number of the people that we had followed were back in the streets. And we knew that the story couldn't end there. And we had to keep filming and we had to keep editing. So we went to Sundance with that knowledge. And we talked about that in our question and answers. And everybody...
You told people this film is now going to change?
We did.
You won an award, and they were like, "Hey, we gave you an award."
Everybody thought when we won the award, everybody thought we were nuts.
But the film went to Sundance knowing that it wasn't finished yet, and it even said that, you know, the film is a work in progress, and that was your line, that just as the revolution is a work in progress.
Why is it worth it for you to go to Sundance at that moment for this version of the film? What are you thinking?
Well, that was a decision by Jahan and Karim, and I think it turned out to be the right decision. It was complicated, but I mean, it was that, you know, there is enough of a film here to push it out into the world. I mean, you have to understand, it's not like this film started knowing that it was going to be successful or that people would see it. You know, you're on this kind of ridiculous process where you've done all of this work and maybe no one will see it. Maybe no one will understand. Maybe you won't end up with a story. Maybe you won't end up with a film. And Sundance was a clear opportunity. And in the weeks beforehand, there were these deep arguments as to whether or not it should go. And I think the fact that really the film did begin to actually have something to say, not just be an active report, but have something to say, that made it valuable to go to Sundance. And as a result, the film was possible to finish the film. And there was a great degree of support, if I'm not mistaken, that followed from Sundance, which gave it the wind to be able to get to the finish line.
Tell us about that, Jahan.
No, that's right. We have had some incredible support come on after Sundance. We've had some grants, and we did a Kickstarter campaign where people donated money to be able to get to the finish line.
I'm trying to imagine what incentives you would offer for this film. You know, like the free T-shirt with a picture of Morsi and a red slash through its face.
Everybody that donated to the film is on the credits of the film. So okay. it's sort of fun. You see all of the people that gave you, you know, even a dollar on the credits of the film. And it just also gave us the confidence that we were really making something that people cared about and that was touching people, even people that didn't know very much about what was happening in Egypt. Because in a bigger sense, this is a story about change and about what it means to make change and about the loneliness of it as well as the success of it. And everybody who's ever wanted to make change in their town and their government has had to deal with this. So we really felt that at Sundance in a big way.
I assume that part of this is that you would like a Western audience to see what you see as the reality of the Egyptian situation.
Having a Western audience and having an Egyptian audience, I mean, both are very important.
Can you have an Egyptian audience?
Oh, we're going to show this to an Egyptian audience by hook or by crook.
Well, I was going to say, is it by hook or by crook? Or both?
We're right now in the process of trying to pass the film through censorship. It might not pass through. If it doesn't
pass through, I think it will not. I'm just guessing. I mean, what do you think, Khaled?
Yeah, no, it might do.
Really? Because why?
When you're in these situations, they tend to kind of weigh, is it going to be more trouble if we ban it, or is it going to be less trouble if we let it through and let it into and sort of try and keep its scale relatively small?
Is this a known thing in Egypt already? Does the average person know that such a film exists?
No,
I don't know. The average person doesn't. I mean, we've put a trailer online that a number of people in Egypt have seen. And so we've been getting a lot of questions about when the film's going to come.
And I mean, this isn't like Saudi. There are theaters in Egypt, I assume, movie theaters.
There are, but there aren't very many. I mean, there are actually 900. I mean, across the region, there's roughly 300 million people. There are only 980 screens, which is less screens than there are in Poland. So when you talk about censorship, in a way, the censorship is infrastructural. It's not just as to whether or not the film is allowed to be seen or not. But to go back to your question, I mean, obviously, this is what's happened in Egypt is a global issue. From a Western audience perspective, part of the value of the film, I think, is that in relation to people's understanding of Egypt, a lot of people have got confused about what's going on. They had some idea about what they thought was going on at the beginning, and then gradually over time, it started to confuse them. And they built this story, which I would summarize as follows, that you had a revolution because you wanted democracy. You got democracy, you voted someone in. You didn't like that person. Well, that's pretty normal. We don't tend to like who we get as presidents either. And then you push them out. What the hell is going on, right? And what this film...
I hope that's not true, because as a person who reads newspapers, I certainly was fully aware of what was going on.
Well, there are perceptions about the region which are entirely false in a post-9/11 world.
Well, let me just interrupt. Speaking of stereotypes, do you find as an actor that you get a bunch of roles where you're playing, that stereotypical...
No, many. I spend a lot of my time rejecting films and scripts that I believe are offensive and racist. As an actor of my background and my origin, you can't just sit there and wait for a script to turn up that suits you. You know, it's more complicated than that. I don't fit the dominant storytelling mode. So what I have to do is I have to engage in changing how those stories are told and how they're made. Sometimes that involves me making films. Sometimes that involves me acting in films. Sometimes that involves me setting up a production company. And sometimes that involves me being out on the street with a camera, holding power accountable. And for me, they're all the same thing, because they're all about storytelling, really.
So where did you edit the film and put it together? Was that a secret project or in Egypt or somewhere else?
That's a very good question. We were editing. We had an office about 5 minutes away from the square. You know, we were living and working out of there and editing out of there. And we kept saying, you know, if Pierre's place hasn't been raided yet, and if Mousserine hasn't been raided yet, which is the office that Khaled was working on out of and uploading footage daily, you know, then I think we're okay. But at a certain point, we actually did get really nervous because Pierre's place was raided and we moved out of Cairo. And then back to Cairo, then we went to London and edited, and then we went to New York, then we went to Sundance, and then we finished the film actually here in LA.
So in practical terms, what do you have to do to submit for censorship?
For releasing the film, we're trying to release it at a festival called the Panorama Festival in Egypt. And normally you would submit the film and they would take it in. We have submitted the film through a person there at censorship who somebody that we know knows. And we are hoping that that actually makes a difference. But we have no idea.
So, Jahan, how much would you be willing to change to get it shown at this festival in Egypt?
Oh, no, we're not going to change any of it. So if it doesn't pass through censorship, we're just going to have to figure out a way to get it bootlegged and release it ourselves.
Jahan Nujaim is a documentary filmmaker. Her latest movie is The Square. Khaled Abdullah is an activist and an actor. He appears in The Square. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here.
The Square is currently playing in Los Angeles and New York. To find out where you can see the film in the weeks ahead, go to thesquarefilm.com. And that's the business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.